Community Conversations with Community Centres SA. Here's Kerry Ackermans.
Well, happy birthday to us all. 1 year ago, we produced our very first weekly Community Conversations podcast. Now, with more than 50 episodes behind us, we would like to take you through just a few samples of the great conversations we have had in our first year.
David Ward, Australian Philanthropic Networks, APS.
Now, David, you would have your own definition of philanthropy, having been involved for so many years, and what structured giving is.
Yes, Carol, it actually comes from the Greek word meaning a love of humankind. So it's about giving, but in a structured way. Why do people give? And obviously, that's a very much a personal thing, and I'm sure every one of your listeners will be giving for different reasons. Now, some give because it's part of their religion. Others give because they've just got a sense of perhaps being a bit lucky or fortunate when they grew up, and therefore they feel an obligation to give back. Others just absolutely passionate about a particular cause, whether it's climate change for a lot of young people or the art or education, you know, that can motivate people.
And David, how did you get involved with philanthropy? Because you come from a very strong financial background.
I, in fact, had a bit of a multiple career and finished up working for ANZ for 20 years. And I, in fact, finished up my last job there was managing their trustee company, which had a lot of the large philanthropic Melbourne-based trusts in it. And I got involved and found it was absolutely fascinating how people, in some cases 100 years previously, had set money aside for the community, and we were still spending that money on behalf of that person 100 years later. It showed that you could keep on having an impact way after someone had left this world.
I think humans need to make sense of things, don't they? And going through the grief process, action, doing something positive that you think that you are helping really can make a difference. That's really common that a grief counsellor will tell people when they've gone through a tragedy.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. And that is one of the big drivers, is that people just say, look, I don't want others to have to go through that if I can avoid it. And a lot of medical research funding and a lot of cancer funding comes from people dealing with that grief. But it also comes from, you know, the other side of human emotion and on the joy and, you know, and the joy of the arts and that overall satisfaction from just being part of a vibrant society. And certainly in Adelaide with the legacy of James and Diana Ramsay, who have done so much for the arts world in South Australia. And that's the joy side of philanthropy coming through.
And you can actually see it in your living time as well, because for a lot of people, they get concerned about living out their own retirement and having enough money. But if you do it in a structured sense, it means that that legacy can grow and you're able to help so many more people and see it happening in front of you, not when you're no longer here.
Absolutely correct. Good example of that was a family that came to APS just over 10 years ago. In 2014, they had a sale of a business. They put $2 million into a foundation because they wanted that to be their sort of community contribution from the success of their business. Roll on 9 years, and that foundation has already given away almost $1 million. So they put $2 million in, they've given away $1 million. And because it's been well invested, and because of particularly foundations don't have to pay income tax, they don't have to pay capital gains tax, they get all the franking credits back, that money has grown. 9 years on, $1 million given away, and there's still $2.3 million there, and it's giving away $100,000 every year. So instead of just giving the money away perhaps at the outset and then it would have been spent and gone, they've been giving the money away regularly. Within sort of 15 years or thereabouts, they will have given away more than the original amount, and the money is still intact and still generating additional outflow to the community every year. We don't make a profit, so any surplus we make has to be put back into the system. Being not-for-profit is seen as a major advantage, I think, for Australian philanthropic services. And then, as I said, surpluses must be applied back to our purpose, which is to grow philanthropy in Australia.
Which is a very important objective. David, your website, so people know where to look you up.
australianphilanthropicservices.com.au.
Lovely. Thank you for sharing about philanthropy today, David. It is important. Now, without those generous benefactors, the charities could not do the work that they do.
Thank you, Kerry. It's been my pleasure.
On our first birthday, we're having a look back at some of our memorable conversations from the past 12 months.
Lisa Miller, ABC TV host and narrator of Muster Dogs.
Muster Dogs, what on earth led you to fall in love with five border collies?
It is amazing that I get to do this, and it is part of my job, and I get paid for it. I still pinch myself, Kerry, that this has happened. And it came about by sheer chance. The Muster Dogs producers are an outside company. They're not part of the ABC. They had pitched this idea about sending out, well, initially with the first series, the Kelpies, and then the second series, the Border Collies, and sending them to trainers all around Australia. The ABC loved it, but they felt like they wanted a voice that was connected to regional Australia to narrate it. And they knew that I had grown up in country Queensland, that mum and dad had been dairy farmers back in the day, and that I still had a very strong connection to the bush. So they rang me on a Friday afternoon in the middle of COVID lockdowns in Melbourne when life was feeling a bit miserable, and they said, "Do you want to narrate a show about dogs?" And I said, "Dogs?" And that's where it all began. I did the first lot of narration in a audio booth in Melbourne with one of the producers on her parents-in-law bedroom in Brisbane, where she was trapped across the border. Another person in Sydney. They were all on Zoom watching me and listening and checking that the narration was going as they had hoped. And then it all went to air, and it was just this mega success that it was our wildest dreams that so many people tuned in on that first night.
What do you think has attracted so much attention and interest from people and from viewers?
Do you know what? I think initially, because it came out in the COVID period, that people were able to vicariously travel with the beautiful landscapes that we were offering them on Muster Dogs. So we took them to Joanie and Atisha in WA and up to CJ in the Northern Territory and down to Rob in Victoria. But the thing that kept coming through was that as the world was getting nastier, especially online, and people were ripping into each other, here was this very authentic, honest, kind, respectful show. And I think that is what really appealed. Sure, puppies are great, and people love the dogs, absolutely give you that. But I think it was this sense that it was a reality TV show that wasn't really a reality TV show. No one was getting the knives out. Everyone wanted the others to do as well as they could do. And that just fed through into our viewership. It filled people with joy. And they came away from watching an episode of Muster Dogs feeling happier about the world, and happier knowing that kindness and joy could still make you be a winner, which is what happened with Frank Finger in the first series. I mean, he was the warmest, loveliest person, and he comes out as the winner, the champion Muster Dog with Annie.
And Lisa, interesting that you say that about that kindness and reality TV shows, because if we use reality TV shows to show the good side of humans, for example, if we take Survivor, if they all work together and the team got the prize, but it does end up being dog eat dog, except I think dogs are much nicer to each other than humans. So I do understand what you're saying about that. And of course, with our community centres across the state, but do you think it is that sense of country that brings community together, that there's something special about being in the country?
Well, there is definitely that. We had as many city viewers as we had country viewers with Muster Dogs. So there was a real appeal of people in the city looking at these communities and how they worked. For me, I mean, the town that I grew up in, Kilkeven, has a population of about 600 people. I'm still super close to people in that town, including my grade one teacher, who lives a couple of doors down from the school where she taught me 51 years ago. So there's that kind of connection that I think that comes through for me that I can help deliver to the audience as well. And there was certainly a bit of wistfulness about seeing these communities for people who were stuck in their city homes, and especially during lockdown. And you saw it. You saw the number of people who were then making decisions to go and live in the region. So, yeah, I think it was a learning experience, Kerry, for both sides, that people in the country kind of were able to explain themselves a little bit and feel like they had a voice, and they were seeing themselves reflected on screen. And then you had the city folk who were like, wow, okay, so these people aren't being awful to their animals, and there are farmers out there who are trying to look after the landscape and the environment, and I see what they're doing here. So it was just one big school lesson, wasn't it, Kerry?
Well, absolutely. And interestingly, that I was listening the other day to an interview saying that the dogs are worth more than people. They've really gone up in value now, and they always want to get to work. Unless they're really sick, they're out there every day without complaint.
Yeah, so Joni Hall, our participant in WA in the first series, used to joke that, you know, her dogs can't take her to the HR department, but she would always say she's jesting because they never would anyway. She was the kindest trainer with those dogs and loved every single one of them. The dogs are, they say that at least one dog is worth two or three workers, and the reason why we need them and we need these great dogs is we just can't get the people out into the regions that are needed to do the farm work that we had in the past. So these dogs are helping out, especially family farmers who are still wanting to stay on the land and not sell up to the big corporations. They need these dogs to help them be able to round up 300 head of cattle to get them in for their vaccinations and all the rest of it. So they are very much needed. But yes, I did track down for my book, because with the book Muster Dogs, that covers series one and series two, and it's all the behind the scenes things that we didn't have time to share on screen, and a lot more of the people story, so we got an understanding of the lives that they had lived. But I tracked down who had bought the most expensive kelpie in Australia at that time, and it was a sheep farmer in New South Wales who'd paid in excess of $30,000.
Goodness.
And of course now, I think the record got broken again and it's something like $40,000. But I would have some nervousness about this, because dogs are great. No matter how much you look after them, they can still get themselves into a bit of strife, you know, and this is why Neil McDonald, the trainer on Muster Dogs, would be so adamant about keeping the dogs protected in cages and to make sure that they were looked after when they were travelling on the back of a ute. There was nothing that would upset Neil more than seeing a dog that didn't have a proper tie, or it had a loose tie, so if it fell off the ute, that would be terrible. You know, it could end up strangling itself. So there was a lot of consideration that went into all of that in the filming and then when I was writing the book. But yes, Capri Eve was the most expensive kelpie at the time when I was writing it, and already we're talking about more money again.
A great piece of information. Well, Lisa, it's been delightful to speak. Thank you for sharing what you have done on our podcast, Community Conversations, today.
Thank you, Kerry, for the invitation.
Now, here's another special guest we had, and our look back at our first year of Community Conversations.
Her Excellency the Honourable Frances Adamson, AC, Governor of South Australia.
What are the key issues you see the community is facing?
Well, thank you, Kerry, and lovely to be joining you today and, of course, your podcast listeners. I mean, clearly the things that one hears about nationally also apply locally in terms of cost of living and the implications that that has for many people in a range of often quite personal ways. That's one thing. I think it's clear also, we all know, again, there's plenty of evidence around, but it's an issue that's raised with me in communities, is housing. And housing, of course, can mean homelessness or people being at risk of homelessness. And through a number of the organisations of which I'm patron, organisations like Hutt Street Centre and like Catherine House and like Food Bank, you know, we can see also that issues around homelessness, around cost of living, are manifesting themselves in increased demand for services from those organisations. But we also see a whole lot of communities doing really well, and in part that's due to the wide range of services provided, including at the community level by wonderful volunteers in a wide variety of ways, a number of them, of course, involving community centres.
And you would say, as you were saying, it's not just homelessness. A lot of the cost of living is exacerbating already existing issues, particularly around mental health. What are you hearing about mental health when you go out into communities?
Look, I think there's a greater awareness of mental health as an issue. I think it's a difficult road, but as a community, I think as a large community, I'd like to think anyway that we're becoming a bit more comfortable about talking about mental health, because it's often very personal. And we know from the statistics that at some point in their lives, the majority of Australians will experience some kind of mental health challenge. And it's something that I think smaller communities tend, I suppose, by their very nature, to be closely in touch with people. And I've seen some really good examples, including on Kangaroo Island, areas which have suffered from natural disasters, you know, fire or flood or the sorts of things to which we're prone in this country. Small, tight-knit communities are very good at looking out for people and keeping in touch with them during what can be an extended recovery phase, often lasting years. I met Tammy Allen, South Australia's new Mental Health Commissioner, the other day. And I think she's got some wonderful ideas for things that we might do even better when it comes to making conversations around mental health more normal, more comfortable.
Well, it is at the coalface that many volunteers to community centres are seeing people with more complex behaviours that they're not equipped and didn't plan to deal with. And there is a decline in volunteerism. What are you seeing out there with volunteers and how they're feeling and what centres are saying and the communities about where volunteerism is at?
Well, as with many issues, I think the answers are quite complex, but through the organisations of which Rod, my husband, and I are patrons, and there are about 170 of those, we're having very regular conversations with those organisations about their volunteers, and we're meeting many volunteers. And I suppose the very first thing to say is that volunteers do such an amazing job across the whole state. If they suddenly either down tools or we weren't able to have them anymore, we would notice an enormous difference. But there are changes underway, some of them sort of structural and long-term and societal. And we recently got a group of our patronage organisations together and asked them how they were getting on with their volunteers and what ideas they had. Because I think for many organisations, COVID was a very challenging time. And not everyone who was volunteering pre-COVID has gone back to it for a whole range of perfectly good reasons. But I think the organisations which need volunteers are increasingly thoughtful about what volunteers are looking for. They want a sense of purpose. They want flexibility around their volunteering contribution, not necessarily the same day every week or the same days or even the same time. You know, including people who've got flexible working arrangements. They want to be able to, perhaps during a particular time of year, the winter months, they like to be able to volunteer more and less at other times. They're looking at how volunteers can actually learn and what the takeaway, if you like, is for volunteers. Part of what I try to do as governor, though, is express gratitude and appreciation for the work that volunteers do, because it is enormous.
Governor, how do you think then that community centres can play a role in helping communities?
Well, look, I think they're, well, the ones that I've seen, and I know this more broadly, including through my role as patron, that they are real hubs, and hubs connect people. Hubs are welcoming places. Hubs provide what can't be easily got elsewhere. And sometimes that's as simple as access to a computer or to someone who can help find information on a computer. Sometimes it's words of advice to people who've newly arrived in the area. And, you know, they can be migrants from overseas, or they can be people coming for work, or they can be people moving out of the city, including because they can no longer afford housing, whatever it might be. But I think making people feel welcome, no matter how long they've been there. And as I say, it's looking out for who's feeling a bit out of sorts, who hasn't been seen for a while, and putting on a range of activities. And sometimes it can be a celebration around a particular day or event. I think local councils have a role to play too. I think mayors and elected councillors can show their support by turning up. And I meet many mayors who regularly drop into community centres and have a chat. And of course, when you're having a chat, you're not necessarily doing the talking. You can be listening and I think being comfortable with silence and letting people tell their own stories is quite important too.
Well, it's been just wonderful to have you as a part of our podcast, Governor, and I just think that encouragement, that gratitude that yourself and Mr. Button show to communities, and we really appreciate your support. Thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure, Kerry, and if I can just thank you in the last minute, you gave me a jar of thank yous at your anniversary last year. I think there were 40th anniversary.
40 for our 40th
there were 40,
birthday.
40 rolled up thank yous. I opened one a day for 40 days. They gave me a big lift.
Here's another special conversation we have had in our first year.
Beck Brown, Spiritual Care Chaplain at the Royal Adelaide Hospital.
Beck, can you just talk to us about your role at the Royal Adelaide Hospital, which I'm sure you see a lot of loss and grief?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I'm one of the spiritual care chaplains there. There's about five of us in our team at the Royal Adelaide. And our role really varies. I guess coming from the understanding that we are, you know, human beings are mind, body, spirit. And obviously if you're in hospital, there's something going on with your body that needs attention, but we're not just our bodies. So we pay attention to people's minds and spirits, and probably some of the few people in the hospital that have the time to just sit and listen to what's going on for people, particularly at end of life. That's a time when a lot of things are coming up. There's a lot of processing being done by families and the patients themselves. And so, yeah, I feel very privileged that we get to sit and just to help them process that, might be regrets they've had through their life. It might be just coming to terms with their diagnosis. It might be just really what matters most to them and wanting to lean into that. So,
and I can imagine, Beck, that being the Royal Adelaide Hospital, that you see a whole spectrum, right, from where it happens in an urgent critical situation through to people know and have a period of time. Are there differences in that experience of loss and grief?
Yeah, absolutely. One of our chaplains is part of the palliative care multi-D team. So every week she goes to the meeting with the palliative care team and sort of work out who's receiving palliative care. And then we offer our services and our support to those patients and their families. And that's often, not always, but often can be a more drawn out diagnosis that sort of we get to journey with that person for a while. But like I said, not always. Sometimes you might only meet that patient once. But that meeting is really significant, and often we're there to really support their families at that time too, and helping them come to terms with that loss. That's very different to being called to ICU where there's been a car accident or something like that, and quite traumatic death. And that can be, yeah, as you can imagine, very traumatic for the family members. And again, often our support is really for the family members who are just in a state of absolute shock.
And would it be fair to say, Beck, that although it's the ultimate end for all of us, it's not something we prepare for or want to think about in our society, is it?
Absolutely. I think our culture is really poor at talking about not just death, but just dying. And, you know, I had one patient once who said, dying's not an option. And I felt like saying, well, it's actually the only option for all of us. And, you know, so many other cultures have rituals that support the process of dying and grieving when someone has died. But our culture, we just want to sort of push it away as far as we can and not think about it, not talk about it. And I find that with families or people who do that, it makes that end stage really even more difficult because they just don't have the language, they don't have any of the tools to actually navigate them through that time. So that's something, I guess, that where we come in and we try and help them to develop some of those tools and just really open it up and say, this is, you know, nothing's off the table. We can talk about anything here. But I've had patients that right up until the end don't want to acknowledge that it is the end. And that's, you know, we have to respect that, and we do, but it does make it, I think, even more challenging for family.
Of course it does. And it's not something that we practice or that we want to practice, is it? And when you think about it, it's one of those things that a lot of people just push away out of their mind. And so when the time comes, everyone defaults to their personality, their experience, their own personal journey, might be spiritual, could be something that they've taken from a specific religious belief. So it's not like you're getting to deal with one circumstance, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, every death is different. It's like birth, you know, there's a process that can follow certain similarities with, like in labour, with dying, but every death is really unique and really different. But yeah, I think people, they just don't, like I said before, just don't have the language. It's something, I think the unknown of it is what is, I find often what just terrifies people. They just don't know, well, firstly, the process, how the death's going to be. There's a lot of fear around, is it going to be painful? But then what happens after? And no one knows, right? It's a mystery. You know, being spiritual care, we work with a lot of patients who do have a form of faith or spirituality. Not always. I mean, we work with everyone. But I find sometimes those patients do tend to have a little bit more peace around the death because there is that sense that there is something afterwards. But saying that, I was with a patient yesterday who's a very strong Christian, And they were terrified. They just were like, now that they're facing it, they said, I just don't know. And that's, you know, totally understandable.
And it's that forever and finality that I think disturbs and worries people so much that they push aside, and how can they deal with that? And often people say, aren't you over it yet? You never get over someone, because if they were important to you, I think the Queen said it best, to love is to grieve. If you love someone, you will grieve if you outlive them.
Yeah.
And that is just it.
Yeah, grief is the flip side of love. I totally agree with that. I think having had my own experience of grief, I lost my dad. He had a sudden heart attack about 10 years ago, and then my brother about 3 years ago. But what I found is that they actually are still with me in a different way. You know, just if I'm struggling with a decision or something and I close my eyes, I can hear what my dad would say, because I had it for 37 years. That doesn't just go away. And so to be able to share that with patients and say, you know, death cannot separate love, that continues, it just looks different. And it's not the same. And there is grief, of course, in losing the human person that you loved, but it continues just in a different way. And I run grief retreats for people who are grieving. And that's one of the things I've found really powerful, is being able to share, like you said before, share the stories of the person that we've lost, that we love, that we miss, tell other people about them, about what we loved about them. And it's just a beautiful thing. And people, I've had many people come on those retreats and say, that's the first time I've been able to talk about my loved ones since they died, like really talk about them. And I thought, what a gift, because you're right. People say, oh, I don't want to bring it up, I don't want to upset them. Well, we're thinking about them always. It doesn't, you know.
So how well would you say we do handle loss and grief in the community?
I think we've got a very long way to go. I think it is changing. I think now that I've moved into this space, and like I said, I run grief retreats, I'm running a recharge day for staff who work in palliative care and end-of-life care in a few weeks. My eyes have been opened that there is actually quite a lot happening in that space, but I definitely think that more could be done. And I think especially not immediate, because immediately after, people are really raw. And most people, not everyone, but most people sort of withdraw socially. They sort of go inside and just need that time to sort of process what's happened. So it's often a few months later, or sometimes even a year or more, that people actually are really ready to look outside and look for those support networks. And often I find them saying, I just don't know where to start. So things like, community centres where they can actually go to their local community centre and find, be part of a group that's able to lean into their grief and their experience, I think is so needed. Things like, I mean, I started my grief retreat because I was looking for something myself, and when my brother died and there was nothing. So I thought, well, I better start one. And I've just found there's been so much interest in that, because there's just not a lot of those sorts of things around, the sort of face-to-face. There's some fantastic things like Griefline, you know, 24/7 phone calls you can ring, and there's a fantastic podcast called Good Morning, and there's things opening up like that online. And, of course, there's grief counsellors that you can go to. But for those sort of, find the group work where you're with other people who just get it, that's what we're missing, I think.
It's a really important topic. Thank you for coming today, Bec Brown, Spiritual Care Chaplain. It has definitely been our pleasure.
Thank you, Kerry. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Now, here's another special guest we had, and our look back at our first year of community conversations.
The Honourable Nat Cook, South Australian Minister for Human Services.
That department, you've got human services, that word human.
Oh, yeah.
I have a lot to do with your team, and they are an incredible team. But for people out there, you really carry the whole people part.
It's rightly called human services, I think, Kerry. But honestly, it speaks to a whole range of issues in the community where people need to be enabled to be able to make good choices and good decisions and have better opportunities. So there is a whole range of areas that we specialise in providing support to and advice. Obviously, we have disability within our purview as well, which has changed a lot over the years. And it used to be quite a huge service delivery agency, whereas it has now obviously got a component of that in terms of residential supports. But most of the disability services get handled by the feds. What that leaves us to do is to talk about inclusion and making sure that all people in South Australia who live with disability of any form are able to have equal access and opportunity. Now, of course, that's a very big statement, and it's also very difficult to achieve in terms of all disabilities all of the time. So our team does a really great job of engaging with the community to ensure that we have the maximum opportunity and access. So disability is a big part but it helps to flow on with inclusion for other marginalised groups. So we are really the department that tries to speak to that access and opportunity throughout the community. And we do that with some of the funding support through concessions and providing those grants to people who earn very low to no income. We obviously try to do what we can for people who are living here in emergency situations as well. We have a, you know, a reasonably small group of programs for people who are here. For example, you'd remember people coming from Ukraine last year, or sorry, I think it was the year before now. We do tailor some of those package opportunities to try and make sure people don't fall through the cracks and they can be supported. Obviously, along with that, we do a lot of work with youth, youth justice, volunteers. I skip over these things, but honestly, Kerry, you could talk for hours about each one of the pieces of work that target a range of people for a number of things. And as a side gig, which is massive, we have social housing. So that includes the community housing sector and public housing, and that provides us with significant challenges. But a lot of people say to me, wow, it's the best time to be the minister in social housing, because we have state and federal governments working hand in hand, and we actually have a flow of real and new money into the sector. So human services, we deal with a lot of human issues and challenges, and we use a lot of our contacts through the community to work on great programs that support people, and that includes housing.
And Minister, would it be fair to say that when we talk about humans, it's your department who takes the brunt of dealing with the emotional side of humans, whereas for the other departments, they're dealing with infrastructure or other set, but you really at the crux of it is a person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess if you talk about our government service delivery agencies, obviously there's health and education as well, and child protection, and they are three other big agencies dealing with specific forms of human issues. But human services is really quite a broad ranging social issues targeted agency, and we do deal with many different types of people. And some people are under the purview of human service delivery for a lot of their lives, but other people come in and out and need to be able to be responded to quickly.
It's a very complex piece. So yeah. You do have a very clever team working with you to deliver on that.
They're extraordinary, Kerry. They are extraordinary.
And I do know, I was listening to you the other day, you're talking about your vision about tailoring back to the individual and not treating them as a group as such, even though they may be within a cohort that you are focusing on.
That's right. And everybody, all people are different. So it's almost impossible to bunch people together, although you have to for the sake of delivering large package funding services. But really, every community has its own individual needs, and all communities in different parts of South Australia need different responses. And within those communities, we then have a range of people needing different responses. So we need to be place-based in terms of making sure that we are supporting organisations such as community centres to provide specific and tailored packaged activities that are going to respond to then within that a range of different types of people of different ages.
And to that end, and congratulations for that vision, I think it's absolutely fantastic. We're seeing the results now. The special part about a community centre is that it literally wraps itself around an individual, where they may come there for one thing but walk out the door with many other things. Only today in a forum we held with some of our community centre members said somebody came in for something financial, they got legal advice, they got food from the pantry, and they met a couple of people while they were there.
It's quite extraordinary. You know, again, for, you know, a whole nother session, we could run through the history of community centres and the evolution and the change. But today, I could describe to you just in brief the visit I had at one of my local community centres, Hackham West. So today, we thought we'd pop in there as a team, our electorate office team, to see what they were doing and whether there was any other supports we could seek for them. We often do a call out for various donations and activate the community. So we popped in to say good day. And what was going on there, we had in one room, we had a yarning circle with a group of Aboriginal women who were actually learning crochet. Day, and they're going to crochet a map of Aboriginal lands across South Australia.
That would be amazing.
It's going to be extraordinary. I said, good luck. Don't ask me. I'm all thumbs, and actually thumbs are pretty handy in crochet, but mine aren't. So they're doing that. There's the food pantry, which is always needing more donations, handing food out to people who need it. There were probably 15 to 20 people eating lunch, being served there by incredible volunteers. So we sat and had lunch, and I had lunch with a gentleman called Joe, who only last week turned 90, and he was able to talk to us about his life and his national service in the UK, coming out to Malaya. It was in the Malay Peninsula, I think he said he'd served, and he talked about why he then migrated to Australia, raising his family locally. We sat there and talked with him. I chatted with Jill Golding, who has recently become the Onkaparinga Citizen of the Year, who was serving on the board of the community centre for many, many years, and a local primary school teacher. And I think she might have been principal as well.
How's that for local involvement? Oh,
absolutely incredible. So we chatted with her. We donated some food goods that had been delivered to our office, so the pay it forward thing happened. They're putting together a garden, a native garden, with a lot of different trees, and like a bush garden with herbs and all sorts that are growing. So there's all of these things happening, and meanwhile people are popping in and out to the op shop, which has been put in place there as a part of their sustainability model. So we spent an hour there, an incredibly rich hour in the community centre, and people of all ages are there. So it's a very welcoming place, and that's the type of place I want to see operating in communities across South Australia, a busy, responsive, welcoming, inclusive environment with a whole range of activities that suit different people. It was a beautiful day, but there are many communities who desperately need that place of welcome and connection. Community centres can be the disruptors in loneliness. Community centres can be the point of access for support, and that's what I want to see in our communities.
Well, I really appreciate you joining me on the program today on our podcast. Minister, there'll be a lot we'll be hanging out to hear about this, and the work that you're doing is outstanding. I really thank you and your team for that.
Thanks very much. Thanks for your time, Kerry.
And that's all for now, and our look back at our first year of Community Conversations. We couldn't have done that without your support. For more info, go to our website, communitycentressa.asn.au. Look forward to our next chat soon.
Community Conversations. For more information, check out communitycentressa.asn.au.